we just exchanged on a one bedroom flat in Notting Hill for 250K. What was amazing, by the time I was 26 years old, I built up a real estate development business. We were one of the youngest Property Week award winners in the country at the time, and also built that portfolio up to about 150 million gross development value. So we had a globalized world. Now we're entering a deglobalized world, which is increasing inflation, increasing rates, and therefore people are going to be hunting for yield. And that's why low income housing is going to go through the roof. When you buy a house in prime central London for 5 million quid, you don't get £500,000 rent. But if you buy a house in Wolverhampton for £150,000, you might be able to get £12,000, £15,000 a year income. So now what the large institutions are doing is they're looking for yield. They're yield hunters. They're thinking, where do we park these billions and trillions of pounds, right? The answer is low-income housing.
Previously, historically then, have the big institutions, have they been looking more at capital appreciation and buying properties and buildings in London, but now they're actually buying two-bed houses?
So the market that they've entered is forward funding, build to rent. Over the next 10, 20 years, with inflation considered, with this wall of capital entering the market, house prices are going to go beyond what the regular person can afford. It's like, no, you can't buy a home, not because you choose not to, it's because you just simply can't afford it. Where do you get income? You get income in low income housing.
When the prison cells are bigger and look better than the accommodation, we have a problem. James, welcome to the podcast.
Good to see you, Samuel. Thank you for having me, mate. This is great.
So you're a property investor based in London, and some of your videos I've noticed have been going a bit crazy. Very interesting. Talking about predictions about the economy, house prices in London actually crashing.
Yeah, yeah.
You said some things that I say
about
this being the last buying cycle potentially with people like BlackRock coming in, buying up all the properties. So I thought we'd have a very interesting discussion. So firstly, thank you so much for coming down. And would you just tell us, what is your background? What gives you the right to talk about the economy? Why should anyone listen to what you have to say?
So I'll cut out the early bit, but in short, as I've shared it with some people, is that I had quite a traumatic situation when I was a teenager. My dad was working in a company which effectively went into bankruptcy. We ended up losing our income, selling our home. And so really I was at university at the time, and I was looking for an internship. And I was lucky enough to find a guy who had taken three real estate development companies public, one in the 80s, one in the 90s, early 2000s. And he basically took me on £7 an hour, and I became his gopher, fetch him coffee at 7 a.m., you know, going to dinner with him even at 9 p.m. And he taught me everything about real estate. What was amazing, by the time I was 26 years old, I built up a real estate development business. We were one of the youngest Property Week award winners in the country at the time, and also built that portfolio up to about 150 million gross development value in terms of dollar value, and began to exit that in 2018 to 2021. And then from 2021, took some time out, got married, kids, you know, enjoyed life a bit, and just started to ask myself, where do I want to position myself moving forward? And then I launched a platform where now we have an asset management company, and we basically buy long-term yielding assets. So the background has been more institutional, perhaps, than, you know, other real estates, you know.
Well, most people in your position that have got a portfolio and have built like you've built would generally be a little bit quiet about certain things. You know, they wouldn't put themselves out there and share what's going on.
Totally.
And the fact that you do that, I know, I have to respect that, because that brings persecution and it brings the certain eyeballs that you might not want.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this, your opinion on why is this the last buying cycle?
Sure. So basically I wrote a paper to our investors, partners, shareholders in 22, which basically said that the way that we value assets is going to begin to be reframed. The way we value property is going to be reframed. And so typically the way of valuing property has been, hey, that house next door sold for £200,000. So my house must be worth £200,000. But the way that, and that's on like a capital value basis, right? But what's happening now is that as we enter into a high inflationary environment, which I said back in 22 was not because of huge amounts of capital that was in the market post-COVID, but was actually due to a breakdown of supply chains because of what I call, which is deglobalization. The idea being is that globalized world order that we've lived in is now breaking down. The agreements between countries are breaking down. So the fundamental cost of moving your iPhone components from Vietnam to the US is increasing. So it's got nothing to do with a huge amount of capital supply, which came out of COVID when the government started printing a huge amount of money. Yes, it was initially, but that eventually filtered through the system. So what does that all mean? It means that we're entering a high inflationary period where fundamentally things are going to cost more and more and more, which means that if you are investing into real estate, it's not good enough that you're going to rely purely on capital appreciation. It's fine when inflation's 0% and capital appreciation on your assets at 4%. But if inflation's at 4% and capital appreciation on your assets at 4%, you've made no money, right?
No.
And so what people are going to begin to look at more from an institutional point of view first is say, well, how do I get an income on my asset? I'm only going to value this asset based on the income I can actually get from it, right? And because debt costs are so high and because inflation is so high, the amount of yield that we need to get on a specific asset is much higher. So in our firm, we think that's 10% gross yield, right? So something's, you know, £100,000, it's got to bring at least £10,000 of income. So the reason why I think this is one of the large buying cycles is that where do you get income? You get income in low income housing, right? When you buy a house in prime central London for 5 million quid, you don't get £500,000 rent from that 5 million quid asset. But if you buy a house in Wolverhampton for £150,000, you might be able to get £12,000, £15,000 a year income. Mm-hmm. So now what the large institutions are doing is they're looking for yield. They're yield hunters, right? And they're looking around at all the different asset classes. They can't buy commercial. They can't buy retail. They're thinking, where do we park these billions and trillions of pounds, right? Mm. The answer is low income housing. It's the buy to rent sector. It's the SFR sector. And what's amazing is that when you get the little, you know, acronyms coming out, what have you got? You've got a product. You've got a product that you can sell, right? So what they've been doing is they've been building up products, SFR, build to rent. And these products fundamentally are just low income housing, which get them the yield, which beats inflation. And also they can service the high debt costs in this new era that we've now entered into post this deglobalizing world. So we had a globalized world. Now we're entering a deglobalized world, which is increasing inflation, increasing rates. And therefore people are going to be hunting for yield. And that's why low income housing is going to go through the roof.
That's very interesting. So yeah. Previously, historically then, have the big institutions like BlackRock and yeah. Lloyds Bank, have they not been buying houses in Wolverhampton? Have they been looking more at capital right. appreciation and buying properties and buildings in London, but now yeah. they're actually buying
yes.
two-bed houses?
Yeah, yeah. Because two things have fundamentally changed. If you've got a team in the office and you know your analyst's on £100,000 a year, let alone your CFO who's on £500,000, mm-hmm. your underwriting costs deploy, say, £1 billion, need to be quite cheap. You can't have 100 guys analyzing 1,000 properties to deploy £1 billion. You want to buy one property to deploy £1 billion. You want to do one deal to deploy £1 billion. So traditionally, that's why Prime Central London, an example, was a gateway for large institutions to deploy large sums of money because it was simple to underwrite. You didn't need many people to underwrite loads and loads of individual houses because you could deploy, you know, 365 million just like the Norwegian wealth fund has just done in Mayfair. But now what's happened, right, is two things. Is one, because commercial's been declining so much, and therefore you can't just have one tenant which rents a whole building, and therefore you can deploy 500 million. The commercial's not strong enough. So the market that they've entered is forward funding, build to rent. So you might do a deal with Vistry, who's a big house builder, which is what Blackstone did. And they said, right, we will forward purchase £1.3 billion worth of the houses that you are building, right? Which the average house value there was like £150,000. We'll forward fund that in one transaction, right? You then warrant the fact that these houses are all going to be of a certain quality so that they've got, you know, they've covered a development risk. And then effectively Blackstone can deploy, you know, over £1 billion in one single transaction and they bought 5,400 homes in that one single transaction. So the reason why institutions have avoided it traditionally is because obviously to underwrite 5,400 homes individually was always just nuts. But now because they've had to search for this yield, it's forced them into this market. And because other sectors aren't performing such as commercial and retail, it's forced them into this market. And so, and the way they've now structured these is forward funding deals, you know, by build to rent, mm-hmm. which is why Angela Rayner's 1.5 million homes is a complete fallacy. Because even if those could be built, those aren't homes for you or for me. Those are homes for institutions to basically forward fund. Because anyway, we could go into in more depth, but that's basically it.
Build to rent, though. I mean, that when I see the big companies do build yeah. to rent, I mean, in a way, if they're building houses, they're bringing house prices down,
yeah.
aren't they?
Well, you think, but it's not down because you think you're increasing supply.
Right.
But you're not increasing supply because they've all been forward purchased. So those 5,400 homes don't actually ever enter the market. There was £1.2 billion of capital that Blackstone put into the market, which didn't exist before. Mm. So that £1.2 billion amount of capital has come into the market, but it's bought 5,400 homes, which also weren't in the market before. So they just cancel each other out.
Right.
So we were building 5,400 homes. They've been built, but they're not for you or for me. They've now been taken out of the supply. So in terms of buying those assets, right, it's just as little amount of stock as there was before.
Why? I mean, you mentioned about the capital appreciation,
yeah.
the aspect of because of inflation.
Yeah.
They don't look to get just capital appreciation. Now they're looking for yields.
Yeah.
And to do that, that's not necessarily in London. Do you think that's why they prices of property in London is dropping, because less there's less investment there? Or do you think it's because maybe of the pandemic that happened and businesses moving out? Because prices are, I mean, if you're looking for a bargain in London, now is, I don't know when that's like it is now in London.
Yeah, so like, I mean, house prices, once they're adjusted for inflation, in Kensington and Chelsea since 2014 are down 38%. And year on year, they're down 15% in nominal terms. So if you think about that in terms of like a £10 million house, it's gone down 1.5 million.
Yeah.
But that's the average, right? That's just actually what's been registered, you know, at land registry. So the I was with some senior guys at one of the big agencies, and they're in my house, and they said, James, you know, we've taken on this block of apartments, this luxury block of apartments in receivership, and we've reduced it 10%. I'm quoting, we reduced it 10%, no interest, no viewings, not one viewing. We've reduced it another 10%, no viewings. He said, we don't know where the bottom is. Because, and the question is why, right? Because when you've got these big luxury blocks in central London and you've got 24-hour concierge, you've got a swimming pool, you've got a gym, and your service charges £100,000 a year on a £2 million apartment, that's not an asset.
Mm-hmm.
So how does a bank underwrite that? How does a bank give you a mortgage when you've got a service charge of £100,000 a year, right?
Yeah.
It's very difficult actually to see a value. So what they're finding is that banks are struggling to value these assets and to lend on them. Now, once you get rid of, you know, the international market because of non-doms, because of the big stamp duty changes that happened in 2014, right? That market was driven by international wealth. 60% back in 2014 in Knightsbridge and Mayfair was driven by international buyers. So you remove that market, there's no domestic market to take that up. So we've seen a complete collapse in central London of real estate prices. So, you know, one of the videos I shared, but we just exchanged on a one bedroom flat in Notting Hill for 250K. You know, it was down from 450. And the question is, why did I agree to buy it for 250? I actually didn't want to buy it. I said to my underwriter, like, I don't want to buy that. I said, we only buy on a 10% gross yield. If that brings in £25,000, we buy it for 250. If it brings in £30,000, we buy it for 300. So that's kind of how we're underwriting things. But yeah, I think what's interesting though is that I then said to the guy, I said, hey, do you think it's a bad thing? Right? Do you think it's a bad thing that prices have gone down 38%, you know, in real terms? Because at the first time now, you've got like British domestic buyers moving back into Mayfair, back into Notting Hill, those areas, right? So the big question is, you know, if we increase wealth taxes such as stamp duty, which went from 3% to 15% in prime central London, assets over 1.5 million, yeah, you do, you know, reject wealth, you do reject capital coming into that market, and prices quite clearly do adjust. So, you know, people talk about, you know, whether wealth taxes work or not. Yeah, I mean, look, prime central London is a really good example of how they can be very effective in reducing asset prices. I think the challenge for us as real estate investors, though, is that what we want to know is that what those taxes are going to be before we invest, right? Because our issue is not the fact that, you know, there are taxes that we need to deal with. Our issue is that we buy something thinking that this is a tax regime, and then while we own the asset, that tax regime changes, and now we get hit because we can't feed it into our numbers from, you know, when we first bought it. So I think that's the issue. I don't think the taxation is the issue. I think the issue is the changing of the goalposts, you know, constantly. I think that's...
So as an investor now, where would you look to invest? Would you look in London? Because the prices have dropped a lot. And usually after a dip, I know the agent said, I don't know how far this is going to go. But normally when you've seen properties drop 10, 20, 30%, there'll then be a boom.
Yeah.
Well, is it possible that there's a boom during, and it's funny because people will see properties falling and they think, oh, it's going to happen forever. Yeah. Or they'll see a property is rising and think, oh, it's going to rise forever.
Yeah.
You know how many years people used to always say to me, London's good for capital appreciation. But the North is good for yields.
Yeah.
But now it's like, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
If you want to get good capital appreciation, you talk about London's great.
Yeah.
Birmingham's outperformed London by probably tenfold the last few years.
Certainly.
So they were saying that because they were talking about the previous 10 years.
Well, I think that's a good point. So again, like, why is Blackstone investing in the Northeast? You know, why is LNG just, you know, building 500 homes in Southampton? You know, like, those schemes aren't happening in central London, right? So again, like, you follow the money, you follow the smart money. And so, you know, is it a good time to buy in London? Look, I think you still need to go back to like basic affordability, right? And at the moment, you know, the issue is that it doesn't make sense in central London to buy a house which is £2 million, because once you go over 1.5 million, right, you're paying 15% stamp duty. So if you bought a £5 million house, you can pay £500,000 in stamp duty. Now you'll pay 2% and selling that house. So if you're going to say stay in that house, then trade up because you get family, kids, whatever it is, you know, you're going to lose 7% of the value of that house. Sorry, another 2% of the value of that house just by selling it. So I think London's still probably got a way to go, but I think where I'm investing and when we're investing and seeing a lot of value is again, you know, genuinely affordable, you know, assets, you know, 150 to 350,000 pounds. Like if we're buying in London, we buy two bedroom terrace houses between 350 and 400,000 pounds. Why? Because the average person, average salary is 35K, two people on a joint salary at 70K times five, which is how much they can borrow, £350,000 mortgage. Yeah. That means that the average person who just wants a family, you know, with a garden, you know, 350, 400,000 pounds. And so if that's what the average person can afford, that's where the most demand is going to be. And that's where the most asset inflation is going to
happen. Yeah. And I think as well with London, I mean, we used to have offices in London.
Yeah.
We had big offices in Marylebone.
Yeah.
And we had about 35 members of staff used to go to work. I used to go to work.
Wow.
I used to go every day, jump on the train.
Yeah.
And I went to London last week. And I walked past the offices.
Yeah.
And I said to my wife, Amanda, I said, I can't believe that we used to all come here every day. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Now our staff work mostly from home.
Yeah.
Got a bit of a hybrid setup, but
yeah.
And I think a lot of people have moved away from that business.
100%. Yeah. I think it's, look, the other thing that we should get onto, but I mentioned the second point why things are changing is because of technology. Like this is a generational buying opportunity because we've never had the technology available in any previous buying opportunity. So 07, 08, we didn't even have cameras on the back of our iPhone, right? We didn't have Google Maps, right? And what scares me and terrifies me for, you know, the public is that for the first time, you can sit in your office in Mayfair, in Berkeley Square, and you can underwrite a deal, right, in Cumbria. You can see all the historical house prices sold. Yeah. I can drop a pin. I can see the whole outside of the house. I don't need to send anybody in my office to go see the asset until we've even agreed a price on it.
Yeah.
So what you're going to find is that all that capital, which is in London, which has come overseas, is now going to say, well, where do we get deployed? And now you're not got a geographical or physical issue of actually having to go physically and underwrite an asset because you can do everything from the comfort of the office. So now it's never been easier to move money out of London to all different parts of the country. And so, you know, the way to kind of think about it is that if those are asset prices, they rise with the tide. That tide is the amount of capital in the market, right? So the more money that is in the market, the more that those assets rise. Now, all that money traditionally has been kept into London for those reasons explained. The fact if I want to deploy £500 million outside of London, I've got to do 20, 30 transactions. In London, I can do one transaction. But now, because of underwriting, because of AI, the ability to underwrite much faster, it's never been easier to actually do 5 transactions, 10 transactions in one go and move that money fast outside of London. And they're going to make that effort to do it because they need to get the yield, which previously they didn't need to get.
Yeah.
Right. So what that's going to do is going to institutionalize the residential housing market in the UK in a way that in London, you're kind of used to, like you've seen it before, especially in Prime Central. But I think, you know, in other cities and other regions in the UK, that people aren't used to that.
So basically, in the way that London for the last 10 years or however many years has just been unaffordable.
Yeah.
And people know you can't just buy a house in London.
No.
They don't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, normal British people that live in London, they'll rent a flat or a house share. They won't buy a house.
Yeah.
You think that that's probably going to become the case in Wolverhampton.
Yeah.
In Cumbria.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just going to be like, you can't buy a house. That's stupid.
You buy houses? That's a strange idea.
Unless you're really rich.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's going to be the norm. And I think,
scary though.
Maybe it was one of your videos actually. I think it was one of your videos. And you said, you know, I speak to younger guys now who, you know, in their teenagers or 20s, I think they're even happy not to own their own home.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I did.
You know, it goes back to
when the World Economic Forum said you own nothing and be happy.
Yeah.
People are happy.
Yeah.
People are just, I'm not bothered.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I just rent.
And I thought about that at quite a lot of depth. And I think that the issue is choice, right? Is that I rent my home. And the reason being for the stamp duty reasons that I shared, if I don't know how, if I, you know, 2 years ago, I didn't have, 4 years ago, I didn't have any kids, right? Now I've got two kids. So I don't know how big a house do I want. And if I need to change out of it, the stamp duty costs and the exit costs are massive. So, you know, my plan is that once I know where I'm going to be for the next 10 years, fine, mm-hmm. you know, then I'll commit. But, you know, I thought at least I have the choice.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's what irks us the most, is that when that choice is removed, it's like, no, you can't buy a home, not because you choose not to, it's because you just simply can't afford it.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's the problem. Because actually, in theory, whether you own, actually not owning a home has many financial benefits and, you know, sensible investment choices. If you can use that capital to invest into other things, it's giving you a good return. And that's actually quite a sensible decision. The necessity, I think, to think equally that I have to own a home and I must do it is also an unhealthy way to think about it. You know, it's not necessarily the best financial decision for everybody.
And you're thinking this is going to happen mainly because of the institution companies that are coming in.
Yeah.
Like Lloyds Bank, BlackRock, that are coming in and buying so many. And it's going to be a case of we can't compete.
Those are the ones you hear about. Canadian Pension Fund invested £1 billion, right? The South Korean Pension Trust invested $500 million, right? This is all in 2022 to 2024. You've even got the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund who just invested $365 million, right? So you've got, even the Qataris since 2008 have invested $100 billion into UK assets since now. And they've generated over $1.2 trillion dollars worth of revenues from those assets, right? From 2008 till now. And so, you know, you hear about the ones that make the papers, but there are thousands of institutions that are investing their capital. And so when we get angry at landlords and we say that landlord owns a second home, owns a third home, right? It's like it's his pension. Like, it's almost pension. Like, they have a right to like look after their family's security. I think the challenge is when you go invest $10 billion, $100 billion. Mm. These are amounts of money that people, you know, can't necessarily even comprehend.
Just think about how many properties
they shift the market. These guys shift the market.
Yeah.
Us buying a couple of houses or whatever doesn't shift the market.
Yeah, we've got six HMOs in a town and people are getting annoyed. And
right.
It's like,
right.
Come
right.
on.
And I think, you know, the second home thing, everything. And I think as a people, as Britain, we need to now like look at ourselves and go, like, are we really going to be blaming each other? Like, there are much bigger threats and challenges to our wealth as a nation.
And another thing as well that we haven't talked about is the fact that money is losing its value.
Mm.
So my wife's parents bought a house in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
For 1.6 million Zimbabwean dollars.
Yeah.
That was in 1997.
Yeah.
Then under Robert Mugabe, the Zimbabwean government printed so much money.
Right.
That house went into the billions.
Wow. Right. So she's a billionaire.
Well, a Zimbabwean billionaire. But here's the thing. The value of the house didn't increase much.
Yeah.
The price did.
Yeah.
According to that local currency, the Zimbabwean dollar.
Yeah. Yeah, which is nuts. And I think, you know, one of the things I was shocked about was when we started posting was I put one video out and I said, you know, real house prices have declined 22% since September. Real house prices have declined 17% since September 2022. And everyone's like, my house has gone up in value. It's gone up. You know, it's crazy. What are you talking about? It's rubbish. Right. I'm like, no, you just don't understand the difference between nominal value increase and real value increase, like once adjusted for inflation. And so if your house has gone up 10% in value, but inflation was 10%, you've made zero growth.
Correct.
You know, and I think people, especially our generation and perhaps, you know, younger than 50, haven't really experienced, probably younger than 60, haven't really experienced an inflationary environment. So the idea that we suddenly need to adjust for inflation is a strange concept.
Well, in Zimbabwe, and not just, I'm talking about Zimbabwe because that happens to be where my wife's from, but there's many countries, Argentina, parts of Brazil, which is where my dad lives now.
Whereabouts in Brazil?
Porto Alegre.
Where's that?
Is in Brazil.
No, because I spent 2 months there last year.
Oh, did you? Okay, well, that's 2 months more than I've spent there, so okay, I have no idea.
Go. It's beautiful.
Yeah. But they printed so much that you'd go to the shop with a wheelbarrow of cash to get some bread.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, that's how bad it was. Yeah. Now, if you go to Zimbabwe, you could go with a wheelbarrow of money.
Yeah.
And that Zimbabwean dollar is just, it's worthless. It's like toilet paper.
Yeah. So, and I think that's part of the reason why I'm still really bullish on real estate. You know, and I think the big underlying thing here as well is that the fundamental, you know, we were talking about development earlier, and the fundamental cost to build houses now is astronomical.
Right.
You know, the bureaucracy, the delays with planning and, you know, the amount of surveys. You know, when I first started in 2014, you know, I was speaking about one of my QSs the other day. We probably need about 50% less pieces of paper than we do now. 50% less surveys. 50% less conditions that we need to discharge. And that whole thing, Section 106, the SIL charges, everything, piling on top. And I think all of that is adding to increased costs. Then you've got a huge number of people who have left the industry. I think 250,000 labor workers leaving the industry, construction workers over the next 5 years. All of that's adding to a cost. And fundamentally, we can't build homes. Robert Jenrick, regardless of which side of the political spectrum one sits, but he was saying, literally, quote unquote, we cannot build homes in this country. And like, literally, that is the problem.
Yeah.
And the cost.
No, it is. Even now, I've got loads of sites. Yeah. Well, I've got planning permission, but now it doesn't make sense to build.
I've got
the permission,
which is nuts.
But it doesn't make sense.
But think how crazy that is.
Because this is another thing. If you're in even the Midlands, certainly the North, talking about places like Cumbria.
Yeah.
There was a guy that came to me recently with a piece of land.
Yeah.
And he said, I've bought this piece of land. I've got planning for 14 houses.
Yeah.
However, I'm struggling to finance the build, and the finance company have pulled out, and he tried to sell me the land.
Mm.
I said to him, brother, I wouldn't take this land off you for free.
Yeah.
I don't want it. He wanted $500,000 for the land.
Yeah.
I said, and this was up north. I said, if I took this land off you for free, it wouldn't make sense for me to build. I went to, I viewed a property recently, actually a Lloyds Bank building, and the agent showed me around and said, oh, they're looking at 290, but they're open to offers.
Yeah.
I thought, 290 for a whole Lloyds Bank?
Yeah.
£290,000, that is. They did the maths. I thought, I wouldn't have it for free. Because the cost of materials have gone up so much. If you're in the Midlands or the north of the country, this is the thing that blows my mind, James. If it costs $250,000 to build a house on average, right? Let's say. But if the houses in that area are only worth $100,000, can only go up.
Right. But this is two really important points that you touched upon. Number one is what you talked about, which is you can only value these assets now on yield. What is the income that that asset is bringing me? Mm-hmm. If I need to go and buy that property and then spend a whole bunch of other capital on it and then get a whatever income I'm going to get, it's not worth it. Yeah. So that's like number one. But the second point is then it also explains why Blackstone and these institutions, right, are piling into the residential housing sector, because they're not buying these houses because they're investing into development and they're going to make a margin. They buy these houses because over the next 10, 15 years, they're getting a yield, getting an income.
Mm-hmm.
So again, like the Vistry, who's a major house builder, they issued a profit warning after they sold 5,400 homes to Blackstone. The question is why? Because they only sold them at such a small margin above what they were actually, the cost of building them, right? They weren't actually making any money. They did the deal just so that they could actually get cash flow into the business to pay all the people who are on the payroll.
Yeah.
Because as you're saying, like, it doesn't make sense to build homes anymore. It does, the cost of it is too great.
So either the cost will have to reduce or the house prices will have to go up.
Yeah. But because we can't afford it, where's that money coming from? Ergo, big institution, international capital comes into the market, valuing things on a yield basis, not on a capital value basis. So like an institution would look at a three-bedroom house in Wolverhampton, hypothetically. I'm making these numbers up completely. We're going to pay £300,000 for that house. You're like, well, that's a stupid number to pay for that house, right? But they don't look at it that way. They look at it on a yield basis. They say, right, over the next 20 years, right, we're going to make this income from that £300,000.
Like how you'd view a commercial
property. Right, exactly.
Because it's a business transaction.
Yeah, totally.
So then they're pushing up the prices. But then new builds of as well, because things like the help to buy. So if Taylor Wimpey come in and build a bunch of houses in Cumbria.
Yeah.
And then sell the houses to people on the help to buy scheme for £250,000.
Right.
All the other local houses that are worth £100,000 are going to have to get pushed up. They're going to get pushed up,
and that's how we kind of were successful in the what do they call that period between 2010 and 2020? Is that like the teens, the noughties?
I don't know
whatever it's all right. But they introduced help to buy in London, right? So flats up to £600,000, you put down a 5% deposit, right?
Yeah.
And the government gave you 95%. So all of our flats were £600,000 because the difference between buying a £500,000 house and a £600,000 flat was £5,000. So everyone was just like, fine, I'll buy that one.
What's the cap before it becomes greedy? Because you talk about how these big companies are coming in and buying all the houses. Presumably you think that's unethical.
I don't think it's unethical. I think it's the fact that people don't know.
Right.
So everyone just needs the knowledge. What I think is unethical is that, and you know, you're a big, you know, proponent of this, is that you educate people to let them know financially what is happening so you can plan for your future.
Right.
So right now, you know, I think it's a great time to be buying assets purely because, you know, if we're right about what is happening, whatever you buy, wherever you are in the country, over the next 10, 20 years, with inflation considered, with this wall of capital entering the market, house prices are going to go beyond what the regular person can afford because mm-hmm. they won't be valued anymore on the basis of what your neighbor paid for it. It'll be valued by someone sitting in a city somewhere on a spreadsheet going, oh, this is the income I could get from it over the next 10, 20 years. Yeah. Right. So I think my in terms of ethics, it's about sharing this information with people
yeah.
so then they can plan for what is happening. You know, we got out of Prime Central London in 2014. We knew what was happening 10 years ago. Well, now people, you know, at home can know what's happening now and they can plan for the next 10 years, which if it was me, it's actually just getting some assets somewhere. One, hedging against inflation. And number two, getting ready for this tidal wave of capital that is coming into the UK residential housing market,
yeah.
which has already started, but is only set to continue. So, yeah.
So what do you think is going to happen to rents as well? Because I think that unfortunately for most people, I think most people are screwed, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think the thing that makes investing heavily unethical, I don't think it's a number. I think it's on a bit like what you said, how transparent are you being? And the problem is with some of these big companies is I think that in their approach, they're elitist because they don't want people to know what they're doing. They don't want people to know what's going on. I don't blame them because when I talk about what I'm doing, I get hate for it, you know, but I'm a very, 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 very small fish in a big pond when it comes to the likes of the big boys.
Yeah.
But I guess rent, I think that rents are going to continue to go up as well. And what's becoming more and more common, like if you live in London, the average person that earns a normal salary, 30 grand a year, 40 grand a year even, the average rents right now in London are about 2.5 grand.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not affordable. So in London, what do people do? They rent rooms, they house share, they flat share.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's going to become more and more common across the UK as well. I think people are going to be forced. Co-living. Yeah. People are going to be forced to have to co-live because rents are going up 10% a year every year.
Yeah.
And unless wages are going up, it's like everything seems to be going up apart from wages. People are not only going to be able to not buy a house, but they're going to be forced to live in a house share. And I think that the standard of living is going to get worse. It is getting worse. It's funny because I was at I was running a conference in London and I said, look, I went on spare room.
Yeah.
And I was going, look, these rooms, they're like a grand. Look at the state of these rooms.
Yeah.
These tiny little rooms for £1,000 of people. But everyone, not everyone, but a lot of people looked at me like, I don't think it looks that bad. I'm like, you know, hold on. Let me do a little social experiment here. I typed in London prison cell.
Yeah.
When the prison cells are bigger and look better than the accommodation, we have a problem.
Yeah, but you need to share that with two people.
Go on.
As in the prison cell, you need to share with two people. At least people get their own space.
Yeah.
That's the only
it's almost getting so bad that prison's not looking too bad.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll just don't have to work, get my meals, be in prison.
Well, I think, you know, in terms of rent, right? And this is like joining all the dots, which is like dangerous, is you've got to deliver 1.5 million homes, right? As a government. The only way of funding these homes that we've established is the fact that you use this institutional capital. But this institutional capital is only investing. Why? To get the yield. But if you introduce this like reform bill, which they're bringing in, right, which then caps rents and puts rent caps in, exactly the same thing that happened in Scotland is you suddenly get a removal of institutional investment, right? Overnight, when they did this in Scotland, institutional capital moved. So what have they done in the new bill? Even in the last spending review, which happened a couple of weeks ago, they've approved the fact that social housing providers can increase rents plus 1% above inflation, right? Even in the new reform bill that's coming through, there's discussions about that you'll have a rent cap of sorts, but basically you will only be able to increase your rent above, 2 percentage points above inflation. Now, this hasn't finalized yet, the amount, but the principle being is that they've understood that if they cap rents completely, that institutional money coming into the market will disappear. Those 1.5 million homes will not get built. So what they've had to guarantee is the fact that rents can continue to rise above inflation. But if your salary doesn't even keep up with inflation, let alone stays above inflation, how are you going to continue to afford your rent over the next 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. And I think the dangerous thing that's happened is that this legislation that's come in the tenancy reform bill, right, it's coming through, is that this is the biggest piece of legislation that's meant to protect the everyday person that we've had in 40 years. And so this is the big moment to like rebalance the situation. And ultimately what's going to come through is that the reforms won't go far enough. Rents will continue to be able to increase above inflation. But as we shared, if wages don't go above inflation, then people are going to have a continuing decline of living standards, mm-hmm. right? And why has this happened? Because they need the institutional capital to come in to build the homes, which, as we've established, you know, too expensive to build in the first place unless they get the income. So you see how the whole thing is perfectly packaged into a book. And I'm not a conspiracy. I don't think necessarily people like plan all of this. I just think that water flows downhill, as in like, as you go through a process, you see the next logical step to kind of get what you want, and you kind of follow that mm-hmm. logical step. And I think as an institution, that's kind of what's happened. So yeah, I'm worried. But you know, what should people do about it is be on the right side. You know, follow the smart money. If all the money is going into those assets, then you should also go into those assets.
Yeah, exactly. And also the fact that, I mean, if you borrow money now and you buy assets with it, the more they print money, your debt is shrinking. But your asset is increasing. If your asset is increasing and you're able to get cash flow from it. You know, so I think that people are very afraid of debt. But actually, if you look at, again, the big companies, if you look at the government themselves, they're not afraid of debt at all. Use it as a tool.
I think there's an interesting loophole here, which, you know, they introduced tax changes in taxation, so you can no longer offset your mortgage against your income.
Unless you're them, of course.
Or you're in a company.
Right. Them.
But equally, mortgages that you take out in your personal name are protected under the FCA, right? Yeah. So they can't, for instance, revalue. So say you own a buy-to-let in your personal name, you get a regular residential mortgage. Mm-hmm. If you borrow 75% and the market tanks 10%, the bank can't put that asset into receivership based on the fact that that property's gone down in value. Right. So if it's gone down 10%, now you exceed the 75% loan to value threshold.
Yeah.
The bank can say, right, I'll take the asset. They can't do that on a residential mortgage.
Yeah.
But they can do that if you own the asset in a company.
Right.
Because then it's no longer a residential mortgage. So you're not protected by the FCA in the same way.
Sure.
So interesting, everyone's being funneled into a place where you're actually even more exposed.
Are you a believer in buying in your personal name?
I'm not necessarily, I think when it-
Because I'm a believer of that, actually. I think there's pros and cons, but I think there's some big pros. I also personally have a feeling that they're going to scrap Section 24.
Yeah.
And I think it wouldn't surprise me if it's that they did that as a ploy.
Yeah.
In the same way as when they did all the stuff they're talking about, EPC.
Yeah,
EPC is about to change. And then everyone sells.
Yeah.
It's a way of getting all the landlords to have a mass exodus. And then, boom, they'll change it back. I think that their goal is to take all the properties, and that's why they're doing these little changes.
Yeah.
And the ignorant landlords that don't really know what they're doing are like, oh, it's not worth it. Oh, renters reform bill.
Yeah.
Selling up. Meanwhile, they're coming in. House prices are going to blow.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, boom. That's why I think we're in the last cycle.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that all that groundwork is being prepared for it. And I do see, as going on to your point, I think this is a generational buying opportunity. And I do see it as a last cycle, because I think 10, 15 years from now, we will have institutionalized our homes. They will become a financial product in a way that we just haven't.
Won't be able to continue with my training business in 15 years' time, because it would just be like, oh, it's not possible anymore, folks.
I think that's a sad thing, you know, mate. Since going online, people ask me like, what should I do? What should we do? What's the plan?
Yeah.
And I'm devoting a huge amount of my headspace to thinking like, what is the next move? You know, where do you go from it?
How do you help people?
Yeah, how do I help people? Like, here's my situation. Here's what I got. What should I do?
Yeah.
And it's getting harder and harder and harder.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting harder. And
well, so, you're in an interesting position, because if you're anything like me, your heart will be saying, I need to share.
Yeah.
But then commercially,
doesn't make sense.
Probably doesn't.
Yeah.
Because the amount of hassle it is.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what though, because I think that something you said recently I thought was really interesting was that the problem is not the wealth gap, it's the knowledge gap.
Yeah.
Which I think that's a very powerful, yeah. if you can, because there's a lot of people that speak like, I don't know if you know Gary Stevens from Gary Economics. Who've diagnosed the symptoms of the problem very well. But there's no solution. So I guess, what in a nutshell, I know you've got a flight to catch, so we need to wrap up shortly, but what is the solution to someone watching this that's thinking, actually, I only own one house, or I don't own any houses?
So Gary and I went to the same university, LSE. I remember the trading game. And Gary's solution at the moment is to put more capital in the hands of the government, which is, that's a solution. Depends on how much you think that then will be spent, you know, reasonably spent.
I'll leave you
naive at best. So I think then, and I think the reason why it's got so much, you know, attention is because it gives people hope, right? And I think that when Labour came in, there was so much hope, you know, even as traditional, you know, even you saw traditional Tory voters, they were voting Labour because they're like, something needs to change. And they were hope. And I think that hope disappeared so quickly. People now are kind of like grasping at like, what's next? And they don't have. And so I think that the other solution then is really to kind of think, well, what is the knowledge that I need? And the kind of comparison I always say is that, you know, if everyone knew exactly what I knew, the people that I knew, everyone knew exactly what you knew and all the people that you knew, there would be no reason why there would be a differentiation in wealth. Like if they knew all the strategies, they knew how to underwrite assets, and you knew how to value property, to find deals, whatever it was, find opportunity. And so there really is a knowledge gap. And what is beautiful right now is, especially in, you know, the work that you're doing and a lot of people out there, is sharing this knowledge. And that knowledge has never been more accessible, you know? So I think all I can say is do what I did, which was I found a mentor back before there was Instagram, the internet, and it was harder. But that guy had taken 3 really sick companies public, and he gave me all that knowledge. He equipped me with that knowledge. I didn't have any money. And I was then able to go and build something because I had the knowledge. So, you know, it's about finding your mentor, finding your boss, finding, you know, whatever it, that person who's got your knowledge, who has your knowledge?
Yeah.
Who is that person who has that knowledge that is the space between where you are now and revealing everything that you want to manifest in your life? You know, who is that person? Yeah. It's not like, where do I get my money from? It's like, who is the person who has the knowledge, who has an effect of gaining that knowledge? You will then receive that capital. You know, that's the kind of like...
Well, James, I know you've got a flight to catch now, so you need to shoot, but if you want to meet up again, you know what I would love to do? I'll ask you publicly if you're up for it.
Yeah.
I reckon we should put on a webinar together, a training program, completely for free.
Yeah.
And just open up to everybody.
Yeah.
And run an hour or two. Deep dive specifically on not what the problems are. We all know how screwed we are, but on practical steps of what to do. So if you're game,
we could run that. Yeah, if we can help people, then we should do it.
Let's do that.
All right, bro. I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Samuel.
Watch this space. Free webinar training session with James coming soon. We'll make that happen for sure, man.
100%. All right, bro. Thank you so much.
Drop a comment, Samuel. Drop a like.